The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning to you. It's 4 minutes past nine on this Friday the 16th of June. I do hope you're very well indeed, and hopefully you're on board with us now for the next 3 hours on this show and throughout the day here on your number one local radio station. It is Highland Radio. I'll introduce our Friday panel for you very shortly. Later on, of course, we'll be joined by Michael and Fionnuala for That's Entertainment, and there's so much more besides between 10 and 11. Right, okay, we want you involved in this conversation as well. 086 60 25000 is the WhatsApp and text number. 086 60 25000, or give us a call on 074 91 25000. And if you wish to watch the show, you can do so on our YouTube channel, Highland Radio Ireland, across our Facebook pages and on our website as well. Just click watch live there. Right, okay. A great panel as always. I could say that every week without fear of contradiction. We can say good morning to Aaron Sweeney, Chair of Young Fine Gael. Good morning to you, Aaron.
Good morning.
Beg your pardon. Sorry, I'm...
Well, how are you?
Good morning. Me? Okay, sorry, I had you all muted and you're saying all hello to each other and I'm trying to introduce you and it's all my fault for once. Aaron Sweeney, Chair of Young Fine Gael in Donegal. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg.
Thanks for joining us. Brendan Byrne, CEO of the Irish Fish Processors and Exporters Association. Hi, Brendan.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
Great to have you on board again. And Mary Cole, manager of Inidni Padraig. Good morning to you. Thanks so much, Mary, for joining us. It's great to have you with us. Okay, we've got lots to get through today. Well, let's start with a bit of politics, because Leo Varadkar's internal party critics are furious with their colleagues, we're told, for publicly praising the Fine Gael leader while privately criticising his leadership. There was widespread support for Mr. Varadkar at Fine Gael's parliamentary party meeting during the week after the it seemed to be organised weekend newspapers were filled with off-the-record briefings by TDs and senators against their own leader. However, the show of strength by politicians loyal to Mr. Varadkar angered his party critics because they believe some of those praising the leader had privately criticised his performance. And then we had polls which showed that Fine Gael are slipping, it would seem. Aaron, as a Fine Gael rep, I suppose I'll come to you first. Is the writing on the wall for Leo Varadkar?
No, I don't think it is. You know, you're throughout any term in government, you're going to have periods where everybody's more than happy with the party leader, and then you're going to have periods where you're going to have certain critics as well. I suppose in terms of, you know, filling the weekend papers full of criticism and then coming back and praising the leader during the week, I suppose that's nothing that Leo himself can control. It would be better, I suppose, if these TDs who have concerns bring up the concerns at party meetings rather than going to the papers with them and then creating news for a week and doing nothing with it then after that. But we're in the middle of, you know, a government that's nearly getting close to the end of its term. You are going to have people, I suppose, trying to position themselves for positions in the future, and they're at a point now where they have to decide what side of the fence they're going to be on when that happens.
Yeah, but I mean, this is part of a process, isn't it? I mean, there's a plan in place here. Of course, we're not going to see who fancies the job, but this is the start of it. This is where you get him to come out and say everything's grand. You get, the leading figures in the party to say, oh no, listen, we're all happy. People like yourself do, but listen, you know, there is a movement within the party that went to a number of different papers, and we know paper doesn't refuse ink. Is this not the start of a process to oust him? There must be something else going on there.
I don't think so. I think it would be, I suppose from my own point of view, it's been no secret I've been critical of Leo in the past, but I am of the view that he should lead us into the next general election. I don't think changing a leader now will do the party any favours at all.
I would love to spend the hour teasing that out with you, to be honest with you, because it's really quite an interesting change in position. But he also doesn't seem to have his finger on the pulse. And when it was first announced that he was going big with the, you know, putting 1,200 euro back in the pockets of middle earners, we discussed it in the show, and I thought, well, that's not what people want. People want you know, access to decent healthcare. They want roads projects to proceed. You know, they want to be able to access services for their children or have those services available to them. You know, a 25, 30 euro per week or whatever it might be, that's not really the priority for people at the moment, even a lot of those that are struggling. He got it wrong. That was his big pitch, and it hasn't played well with the voters. Most want public spending over tax cuts. His fingers is well off the pulse.
I'm not sure if that's the case, Greg, to be quite honest. As I do think people, with the cost of living that has gone up recently, I do think people do need to see more money back in their own pockets. It has been long. It's not that he's suddenly come out and said we want to take money off or away from the taxes and we want to put money back into people's pockets. This has been long-term Fine Gael policy. So it should come as no surprise that Leo Varadkar is coming out and saying that we want to cut a lot of money from the income tax bill of regular workers.
But that's the point, though. That's the point, because the poll out today shows less than 10% of the public gave tax cut as their first or second choice. Instead, 40% said their first choice was to invest in building infrastructure, such as public transport, housing, hospitals and schools. A further 25% of voters said their first choice was to spend on public services, such as health and education. So he if that is long-term Fine Gael policy, it's out of kilter with the public's wishes.
Well, I think, you know, when we're talking about public spending, public spending throughout the last term of this government anyway has gone up in terms of what it used to be. So money for services are increasing to a large extent, maybe not as much as what people would want, but we have to be reasonable with the budget as well. We have to be responsible with the budget. We can't be going, you know.
But Aaron, come here. The public want you to be responsible. They want you to invest in the everyday stuff. They don't want you to throw cash at people to try and win votes. Okay, listen, I'll come back to you. You're not here to speak on behalf of the government. It just so happens that you're a member of Fine Gael. Right, yeah. Shall I go to you, Mary, next? I mean, do you think the writing's on the wall for Leo Varadkar? I mean, listen, he's had a controversial tenure over the last while. You know, the public don't forget the days where things went off the front pages and that was the end of it are over now. The public think for themselves. They source news in different places. They don't allow the mainstream media to set their agenda. And there's still an awful lot, I think, that went on with Mr. Varadkar that they're still not happy with.
Yeah, I really do think his days are numbered. I think, you know, when you look at the housing crisis, the state of our healthcare system, that is what the people want fixed. That's what we see that needs fixed here on the ground. It's not the people on low income anymore. It's the working class people. That is the people that we can see that is struggling here. And it really needs to change because the housing is a mess. Our healthcare, we can see it here. It is a mess. And I just think, as you said earlier on, Greg, I just think he's gone the wrong way about it, you know, and I really think it's time that somebody else took over and try and make a better job of all of this. I don't think in the job that I'm in 16 years that I have seen people struggle as much as they are struggling now.
Yeah, and I think for the squeezed middle, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not a politician, I'm not a financier, but I think, you know, maybe some flexibility or widening of bands for SUSE grants, for an example, or access to certain, like a medical card or HAP or something. Do you know, that's what people really might make a change in their life, not, you know, just slightly more in the wage packet every week.
Absolutely. I would say now that in the past, people going for cancer treatment would always get a medical card. Now they struggle to get a medical card. People that are up and down to Dublin, up and down to Galway, can't afford this. They really can't afford to be doing all this. And there has to be a better way. There has to be a better system. We have to fix what's wrong. There's no point in throwing more money at people. They have to fix the problems, and the problems are our hospitals, the housing crisis, the education. You mentioned there the grant system. The working class people do not, they cannot apply if they are on a certain threshold. They cannot apply for the grants. How do they expect us to send our young people to college? And then you're talking about the rent increase in Dublin and in Galway. I just can't understand how the government thinks that the normal working class people can manage this.
And I think, Mary, this is often highlighted with this sort of, it seems a little bit of detachment in that, you know, we're told how strong the economy is, that we have to be prudent with excess cash and all this kind of stuff. But the truth is people are living their lives now like we are broke and in a recession. And that's the truth. Right. So all the talk of we have to be prudent with this, that and that, people are saying, as far as we're concerned, it feels like there is no money in this country because we are living our lives like we are in the throes of a recession.
Absolutely. People get paid on a Friday and by Tuesday, Wednesday, they are broke. They just don't have the money for the rest of the week. You know, and this has really got to change because people are struggling. People are struggling to manage. They're trying to pay their electricity bill and those kind of utility bills first. And then they're struggling with food, the normal things that you buy on a weekly basis. That's what they're struggling with. And, you know, everybody keeps saying things are getting better. We don't see things getting better. In fact, I would see more and more families struggling.
Yeah, we'll focus actually maybe a little bit more specifically on what you're seeing, because we spoke to you and some of your colleagues not so long ago, and it was really impactful to have people at the coalface like yourselves laying it bare for what it actually really is. Right, Brendan Byrne, CEO of the Irish Fish Processors and Exports Association. Very interested in your views on this. I mean, you've seen how the conversation has sort of developed, but I suppose first and foremost, you know, you've been in politics for a long time. You know, it's a tough game when the writing's on the wall. It's hard to scrub it off, isn't it? What's your feelings as to what's going on at the moment for Mr. Varadkar?
Well, I was going to start by saying my own personal experience since I got this job 2 years ago. I obviously entered the job with a particular viewpoint of Mr. Varadkar, and over the last 2 years, I've met him on numerous occasions. So the public persona of Leo Varadkar is very much different to the individual. And as I said, I have met him lobbying on behalf of the fishing industry. And of all the politicians that I've met in the last 2 years, he's the most clear-cut in making a decision. He shows the best leadership abilities of anyone that I have met in my political life. So there is a massive disconnect between Leo Varadkar, the individual, the politician, and how he's portrayed in the media. And I can only speak positively about him in my role here as the CEO of the Irish Fish Processors. That being said, what has happened over the last 2 to 3 weeks is baffling to me. Because if you look at Fine Gael polling, over the last 20 opinion polls, they're consistently ahead of Fianna Fáil by 4 or 5 points. Wind back to 3 weeks ago and Fianna Fáil take a lead over them, and their backbenchers or whatever is happening internally to the party take a hissy fit and they're panicking. Now, they need to get a grip of themselves, because in actual fact, if they look at the opinion polling as a whole over the last 18 months, they're doing extremely well. We must be mindful that the day that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael decided to go into coalition together, they immediately assigned a third of the voters to Sinn Féin. They broke the dynamic of politics that's been in this country for the past 70 years. And I think the backbenchers need to take a reality pill there and realise that the dynamic they have created in going into coalition with one another, that they don't realise what's facing them when the electorate comes around. That the traditional way of voting is long gone. It's certainly gone since the last general election, particularly since they went into coalition with one another. So the question is Leo Varadkar's time up? Well, I can't see it. I can't see an alternative within Fine Gael that would be of equal stature to Leo Varadkar. I think his main problem, if I was to be critical of him, is that he needs a better media strategy. He needs to portray the real Leo Varadkar. I know that media can, on occasions, take a spite into a politician. I'm not saying that this is the case here, but he certainly has a media identity problem. So, no, I don't think Leo Varadkar's time is up. I think Fine Gael would need to take a hard, cold look at themselves, where they're going, particularly those that are mounting this campaign. And it is a campaign. Look at here. You said it yourself, Greg. This didn't happen in the newspapers by accident. This is a choreographed campaign to see how strong the possibility would be to oust Varadkar. But I certainly can't see it happening. And I certainly, personally speaking, in my role here as the CEO, I hope it doesn't happen, actually.
Yeah, which is interesting and honest as well, which is very much appreciated. So Aaron, you believe, finally, before we take a break and move on, you believe that Leo Varadkar can ride this out?
I certainly do. I believe it's not the first time he's going to have to weather a storm within the party. I would agree wholeheartedly with what Brendan said there in terms of the media. He definitely needs to work on his, I suppose, appearance within the media and his media approach strategy. If we take a look at the Leo Varadkar who started out in this government as Taoiseach, who was, you know, everybody looked on him. We're almost saying Micheál Martin has to go to him for permission before he could do anything. Whereas now, we're not really seeing that same strong character out in public. But I do believe, you know, when, as Brendan said as well, Fine Gael, we're going to be facing, you know, a new opposition in Sinn Féin. He is the man that can lead us into that election, into that battle. And I do believe that he is the one that will give us our best chance at going back.
Do you not think, though, do you think he is? Because when I see the exchanges between he and Piers Doherty, for an example, I don't really get the feeling that he's winning those battles. I think he talks of things that the voters aren't listening. Like, he might in his mind feel that he's scoring points, but I think viewers to it are going, well, really, is that you have to dig into the history books to, you know, I'm not saying that's exactly what he's doing, but you know what, I don't really think he's actually really good head on with Piers Doherty personally. I don't know, maybe you feel differently.
Personally, I would wholeheartedly disagree with you. I think it's been far too long that we've had in Fine Gael nobody able to challenge the rhetoric that comes out of Sinn Féin, out of the likes of Piers Doherty, whereas I do believe that Leo can challenge him, take him on very well. But at the same time, we have to be mindful, Fine Gael aren't exactly going after Sinn Féin votes, nor are Sinn Féin coming after Fine Gael votes. It's more, I think, for the two of them trying to maintain their own support and show, look, we're able to take these guys on.
Aaron, you're really toeing the party line today, right? If there's anyone standing behind the camera, blink twice and I will send someone over. Blink. No, you're okay? Right, okay. Just, he used to be a renegade, Mary. Now he's a good boy. Come here. As finally for you, Mary, just to that point I was putting to Aaron, and Aaron knows I'm joking, of course. Mary, do you think Leo's the man to take on Sinn Féin then? You seem to not be agreeing as Aaron was speaking, if I'm reading the room correctly.
No, I don't think he's the one to take on Sinn Féin at all. I don't think so. I'm not a big person for politics now. I must be quite honest about this. Then I'm one of these people that when you're in my line of work, you will go to anybody that helps you, you know, but without breaking, you know, my own confidence. What I talked about, what party I follow myself, but no, I must agree with you there that any time that you see Leo Varadkar and Piers Doherty, I think Piers Doherty just really...
And I think, Mary, too,
winning.
Yeah, someone in your position, and perhaps in mine to some extent too, at times it feels that maybe you see really how politics works or maybe sometimes doesn't work, and it's what an individual can do to pull a few strings for you because you're so frustrated by policy that you might feel, not putting words in your mouth, that whomever is in there, it's unlikely to change and it's going to be an onward battle to try and get in touch with the right person to make the right connections. You know, we're not going to see a policy whereby the this state funding of food banks, for an example, or support of them? Or is it like, am I reading your comments correctly there?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think, you know, in the roles that we have as community and voluntary and working with the community, I can't see any big changes, no matter what party comes. As you say, there's policies there that is so difficult to get around. There is so much red tape. I think sometimes that, like that food equality forum that was in Letterkenny, I could not believe that there was nobody there from any of the parties to listen to exactly what was going on the ground. I must say, I was absolutely astounded that nobody was there. And I challenged a few people and said, why were you not there? Why were you not there to listen to the people on the ground, the problems that people are having, your voters, the people that vote for you? Why were you not there to listen to that? And I think our next step is that if they're not going to come to us, we really need to go to them, and we really need to say, you need to see what's happening in your communities. You need to talk to the people on the ground, because there is where the problem, that's where the problems are. So I think the way it is that sometimes they're all battling up there for their place in the polls, that they forget what's actually happening on the ground.
It's sometimes it feels a little bit like, you know, two bald men fighting over a comb. It's not really,
exactly.
Not really what affects what affects people on the ground. Okay, really interesting, of course, from Mary Coyle. We've got Brendan Byrne on the show and Aaron Sweeney as well. More from all three after these. Now, we heard from historian and teacher Dr. Joe Kelly yesterday his concerns that we're dumbing down our children's education. He mentioned, for an example, the Junior Cert History paper, which included questions that were effectively spot the difference. You know, two pictures of hurlers from generations apart. What's the differences there? And other questions really sort of focused on simple math. He was also critical of that controversial Leaving Cert Maths paper, which he said threw students off his subsequent exams. So do we need to make sure that we're, we're educating our children to the highest possible standards? I'll start with you, if that's all right, Brendan Byrne, because I thought it was quite interesting to sort of get an insight, because I think, is it fair to say the majority of parents sort of send their children into school sort of based on presuming that everything is being done just as best as it can be? Do you know what I mean? So what have you on this, Brendan?
Yeah, of course. Look, I come from a rural community where we only have the one school, but in places such as Letterkenny, there would be an awful lot of school picking going on in terms of where the best results are. That's not really the question you asked me, but it's a factor in the Irish education system. Now, in terms of where we are with the junior cycle, I tend to agree with Joe Kelly on this one, that the Inter-Cert, which you and I would have sat many moons ago, was a better exam than what the junior cycle has now turned out to be. So I think it's probably about 15 years ago now, the government took a decision that the junior cycle was just a trial run for the Leaving Cert. The Inter-Cert was never that. The Inter-Cert was an exam that could deliver you an apprenticeship, that could give you a pathway to further education. We need to get back into that space. So in terms of where the junior cycle is, it's an exam without meaning, and that's wrong. That is completely wrong. And likewise, if you look at the Leaving Cert, in particular the maths paper, which was a horrendous blunder on the part of the examiners that set that paper, particularly because it's the exam year this year are the class that were out of school because of COVID. So the sensitivities of what they did was madness, absolute madness. But we need to have a fundamental discussion in this country about our exam system. If you look at 13 to 14 years of education, all boiled down to 6 hours of exams for a maths paper, 6 hours for an English paper, or 2.5 hours for a biology paper. If that is the best we can do as a leading country of the world, then there's something fundamentally wrong. I cannot understand why some government somewhere needs to say that from junior cycle to the last exam that you do in the Irish education system, why that cannot be a continual assessment. We are putting phenomenal pressure on our children they spend their 13 to 14 years in school, and it all boils down to two exam papers, 6 hours of their life. That is completely out of date with what's happening elsewhere globally.
Yeah, it's not efficient, is it? I mean, it's inefficient, and it puts so much pressure on young people, and there are better ways to do it. But who drives this reform, Brendan? Because it feels like we've been talking about it for quite some time, and they're tinkering around the edges at the moment. Surely now is the time to say, well, let's not, you know, make a few changes for the next wee while. Let's actually look at what we can do and what, you know, positions us best for the future.
Well, you said it. We are tinkering around the edges, and we've been tinkering around the edges for the last 10 to 15 years. And the more tinkering we're doing, the worse we're making it, because we're avoiding the fundamental decision, and that is major reform of the Leaving Cert. The Leaving Cert, as it is, by and large, as an exam, is exactly as it was 40 years ago. The world has changed in that 40 years. And I would even go further that we need to align our secondary education better to our third level education. The transition from second level to third is so daunting for so many pupils, as you can see from the fallout rate. So we credit ourselves, and we acclaimed ourselves for the last 20 years as being world leaders in education, and we were that. But you look at the tables in terms of the third level colleges globally, and I was on the Higher Education Authority for 5 years. We are slipping and slipping and sliding, and we're at a point now where this debate that I'm calling for should have been had 5-10 years ago. So we're now at a point that we are at a crisis in terms of where our education is. And Joe Kelly is right. The junior cert has become a farce. That shouldn't be. The junior cert needs to be a springboard, particularly in vocational education, for those in a different pathway throughout education.
All right.
Similarly, our Leaving Cert needs major reform.
All right, Aaron Sweeney, what's your view?
Well, I suppose, first off, I am a history and English secondary school teacher.
Oh, right. I actually didn't know that, by the way. What a beautiful coincidence. Go ahead.
Yeah. Just in terms, I suppose, the history, yes, the history exam for junior cycle, you can make the argument that it looks simplistic, that it has been dumbed down, that you know, that anybody should be able to have a go at it. I marked this paper, not this year, but last year. I marked this paper last year. And there was areas in that too where you had simplistic questions. But compared to the old style paper, there is a lot of areas where you can easily lose marks, and all of a sudden you're coming down a grade rather than going up. The other thing about the junior cycle paper, I think it is, when it comes to the common level papers, anyway, they are in some ways not allowing higher achieving students to show their ability as much as what the old exam used to. But what it has done is it has brought up weaker students who never would have been able to probably get a grade of that standard before. They're able to.
But is that not exactly what dumbing? Is that not what dumbing down education actually is?
No,
it's
no,
trying
no,
to,
no.
Rather than trying to bring children up to a level, we're bringing the exams down to a level.
We're not bringing the exams down to a level, no, but we're making it more accessible. I do believe that the new junior cycle isn't all that, I suppose, what they were trying to shape and make it out to be, but it definitely has improved things a lot for weaker ability students, and that is something we can't ignore, and I don't think we can backtrack on.
Can you tell me why that's a good idea? And as I say,
from my own opinion, my own experience, people of weaker ability would have been, I suppose, disengaged as a result of the course that they were doing, not being able to access the course as well, and then we're leading to them leaving school early when they really didn't need to. And I do believe we should be keeping students in school for as long as possible. And especially those maybe who are going on to a vocation, the LCA programme has changed dramatically in recent times to really be, I suppose, a foot up for those students. And it allows them to stay in school longer and, I suppose, mature that wee bit more before they do go out into the working world. And that will stand to them in the future. In terms of the Leaving Cert itself, unfortunately, we're back in this situation where we're having problems with the math paper yet again. It's something that the SEC doesn't seem to be able to learn from. But this year, it was more so disappointing than most. I mean, I have plenty of friends who are math teachers, and I was speaking to one this morning, Greg, before I came on, and she said to me that, you know, we need to be encouraging people to do higher level maths. But what happened the last week did the exact opposite. It made students afraid of higher level math. You know, the question phrasing was different to other years to what they had prepared for. This was a group of students who had never sat a state exam before, and the SEC knew all this going into it. So if anything, for me as a teacher, speaking to my fellow colleagues, what needs reform is the SEC and how they set their exams.
Yeah, and Dr. Kelly made the point yesterday, which I thought was interesting. You were speaking to a maths teacher, but it was them being shook after that, then going into the next exam and how it might affect their performance there. And then the subsequent, I think the second exam after that might have been Irish or whatever. And I think that Dr. Kelly would have an interest in that, that this was one of the first exams, if not the first, and it just chucked them out of kilter. And then they talked then about this bell curve, whatever it's called, in terms of, you know, how it's going to be marked, and it should take into account the difficulty of the paper, but it doesn't take into account that maybe not every student answered all of the questions and what have you, so they could still be very well disadvantaged by this very difficult paper. And that then snowballs onto them what course they might get into the future. Like, it has big ramifications.
It has massive, massive ramifications. And look, I know when I sat my own Leaving Cert, Math paper one was difficulty with back in 2015. It was controversial at the time, and I do remember being in that position over the weekend, panicking about what's going to come up on paper two. Now, they'll tell you that if there's a difficult paper one, paper two is going to be more accessible. That doesn't help when you've already gone through the stress of sitting through that paper. You're thinking, oh, rather than studying, you're thinking, I'm not going to get the course that I want because of that paper. And if we can just make the both papers line up with each other, rather than having one harder and one more difficult, students will have a better chance.
All right, just before we bring Mary in, a direct question then to you. You are not of the view that we are dumbing down the Leaving Cert, the Junior Cert and Leaving Cert, and producing students that are less well educated than those that went before them. You're confident that we aren't, at the end of the secondary school, we're not producing students who are leaving with less knowledge than those that went before them. You're happy that's not happening?
From my own background, I don't think that I personally am teaching a dumbed down course. I don't think personally that the students that are sitting in front of me 5 days a week aren't getting the same education I got, for example. The exam itself, definitely there needs to be maybe some consideration that changes, but the actual way in which the course content is delivered and taught, I have no issue with at all.
All right. And just one final question for you, though, because you were very key, you're passionate about history and wanted it retained in the curriculum. In terms of the questions, you know, as I say, about comparing one hurler from the 20s to one hurler now, and even questions as it relates to Northern Ireland effectively were maths questions, not really educating people about their history and the politics. Would you like to see questions that actually challenge the student to learn as well about our history?
Yeah, I suppose I'm not against maybe moving back to the old higher and ordinary level model for all subjects. The higher and ordinary level model for junior cycle only exists at the minute for Irish, English and math. But I'm not against bringing that back in the future if, I suppose, the results show that that's what's needed. In terms of, you know, you mentioned there a question that involves students' math skills. We have to incorporate numeracy and literacy into all subjects nowadays. And believe it or not, numeracy has a massive role to play in history. We have dates, we have timelines, we have all these things that people in exams were not recalling to a great extent. The new junior cycle focuses on, I suppose, improving those numeracy skills, improving those literacy skills. So I'm not against those type of questions appearing in the future either.
Yeah, I think I kind of put that point to some extent on the show yesterday. Mary, what do you think?
I suppose I'm coming at it from a different view altogether. I think what we need at the moment is we need to build resilience in our children, in the youth of today. And I think, you know, there are so many children out there that suffer from anxiety, and there are reasons for that. I know that. But it's funny, I spoke to a student last night, just knowing that I was coming on the show this morning, and I spoke to a student last night and I asked for his opinion, what did he think? And what he was saying was he had missed the junior cycle because of COVID, and that he was very nervous because of the exams, because you didn't have that chance of time management, you didn't have that chance to know exactly what it's like to sit down to a state exam like that. And that whole thing was causing him a lot of anxiety. And also speaking to a former teacher who sat outside the school waiting for his daughter to come out, and she came out in floods of tears because of the maths exam. And pretty much was given up on the whole of her Leaving Cert because she had felt she had failed that paper. How do you go into another exam after coming out of that? It's very difficult for children, you know. I definitely think there needs to be a reform there. And listening to the former speaker there, he explained it very well, you know, that especially with maths papers, that they need to be... the maths paper 1 and 2 needs to be similar to each other. You know, maths paper 1 just unnerved all the kids going into another exam afterwards.
Okay, back with more after these. Mary Coyle, back to you just on that word you used, resilience. Do we need to have maybe a national conversation on that about... just about resilience. I don't want to sort of lead it in any direction. I kind of want your views on it. What do you mean by that, and what do we need to do?
I think children of today are under immense pressure. I think, you know, that it's very difficult for them. Maybe, you know, over this past couple of years didn't help them in any way at all. But I feel, and I'm sure you must agree, that children are today are a lot more anxious. We run a lot of kids.
Yeah, but what is leading to the anxiety, though? In other words, you know, what are we not equipping them with to be more resilient to the realities of life that might prevent them becoming anxious, if that's actually a scenario that exists?
Well, probably, I think a lot has to do with parenting as well. You know, that a lot of parents now are friends to the youth and the children, and not parenting as much as they should. That I think that is one of the biggest problems there is. And then I think it's the society that we live in, that kids are a bit more anxious because, you know, maybe mum and dad are struggling in some way. Maybe there's something going on in the home. COVID didn't help. All of these things, I think, it's just a more difficult time for youth, for the youth. I think, you know, at school.
Let me say a scenario, and it's not across the board, though. Is it a case that... we talked about and I'll bring Brendan and Aaron in a second. We talk about that transition year, so that transition from second level education to third level education. That oftentimes I wonder, we're putting them on the bus or driving them down to college, and you know, it's like that's their first experience of maybe real life, looking after themselves, caring for themselves, being emotionally independent. Like something's not happening now. Is it that we were wrapping them in cotton wool? Are we too afraid to discipline them for fear that they could have a mental health issue? Or, you know what I mean? And I don't want to be insensitive in my language, but I do really think we need to talk about what's going on. It's not across the board, of course, but it's large cohorts of our youth, I think.
Absolutely. I agree totally. And what do we do to fix this? You know, that's maybe the question that we need to find out, you know.
But we talk always, all our conversations are about how parents can understand their children, how they can protect their children, how they can make life easier for their children. There's no guidance on how to actually parent your children, which sometimes involves you know, ripping the router out of the wall, taking the Xbox or PlayStation from them, taking the phone off them, you know, being prepared to tolerate them in a mood for a couple of days. Do we give in after 5 minutes because life's too tough anyway? Or what are they doing in the room? Are they harming themselves? Do you know what I mean? We're not, I don't know, is there any guidance for parents on how to parent that requires a little bit of, you know, tough decisions?
And that's all right, because it's the most important job that we all do in this world is raise our children. And there is no guide. You know, you just go in there and you do the best that you can. And we're not condemning parents and we're not coming down on parents. Most parents are doing the best that they can in the situation that they're in. But it's definitely got to the point that parents is very much... you know, they're trying to please the children a lot more than they used to.
Brendan, you know, do you think we need
fear
to...
of all those things.
Sorry, Mary, I beg your pardon. Brendan, do you have your concerns? Do we need to have more of a conversation, I suppose, on how to best prepare and protect our children, but that sometimes means not being their best friend, you know, not necessarily being incredibly popular in the house?
I'm not so sure it's just a sole parenting issue here. We have a societal issue. If you look at social media, if you look at the interactions that our daughters and sons can have compared to us, you know, I'm not that terribly old, but I didn't even have a remote control television. So here we have now in their hands an iPhone and an iPad and all this connectivity. And in this connectivity, you have a world of its own that's leading to very much peer pressure, social pressures, bullying pressures. And I, as a parent, don't have the toolkit to cater for that. I'm catching up, I admit.
But Brendan, you still did have, not you literally, but our generation, I suppose you could call it, you still had the issues in the playground. You still had the bullies. You still had, I remember there being school discos in the John Bosco Centre and I had nothing to wear and the stress of going in, you know, older brother's jumper or something like that there, and then you went in and repeat, you know, there still was societal pressures there. Now, of course, it was never ever present and in your hand and all that kind of stuff, but it still was tough growing up at times too.
No doubt, and I'm getting nostalgic when I hear you talking about swapping jumpers and everything like that. Look, we all did that, but when you compare that now to what our children are experiencing in terms of social media bullying and everything like that. I recall quite vividly, Greg, and I'm sure you did too, when we had bullying in the yard, there was always a gang or two that would corner the bully and then that was the end of that.
Yeah.
How you do that in terms of Facebook or Twitter is where we are.
Yeah.
But Mary's point about resilience, I accept that maybe perhaps our children are getting more susceptible and therefore less resilient. That is a problem. That is a societal problem, much broader and deeper than what we can solve here.
Yeah, and you talk about the pressures young people feel with social media. I actually think their parents can't handle the pressures of social media themselves because it's new for them too, to a great extent. And you try and help your children, but you feel yourself, you post the wrong thing and you can be wiped out, you know, effectively. Aaron, what's your views as a younger person?
Yeah, from my own point of view, I think, you know, doesn't matter if it's in the classroom, the playground, at home, in front of the parents, the big issue is the mobile phone. It's social media. And the problem with it is there is no clear-cut answer. And everybody has an opinion. And everybody believes their opinion is correct. You know, we were talking about bullying there, and it used to be a case, yes, but of course there was issues when people were growing up before mobile phones. Yes, bullying existed, it always has existed. But the difference was when bullying took place at school or took place out in the open, people had the safety of their own homes to go back to. That doesn't exist anymore because of the mobile phone. As well as that, there's pressures on young people to do things so that it can be filmed. I mean, we had issues in Milford during the week of fights that were filmed and broadcast through WhatsApp to different people. You have all these things that are happening through that one wee device, that mobile device, and there is no simple solution for it. And that is going to be a major problem.
Yeah, and even now, you as a teacher, you know, if you wanted to Google your name, who's to know what you might find students saying about you, Brendan, in your role and your previous role as a politician, you know, search your name. And Mary, I'm sure it's the same for you and it's the same for me as well. And yet we're the ones, and maybe not you just quite yet, Aaron, I don't mean that in any way patronising, that then are having to teach our young people to deal with it. And yet we're probably working through to some extent how to deal with it ourselves. Just a quick one, if you don't mind, because we only have a couple of minutes. A private member's bill proposing that Ireland adopt a former honours system akin to those in other countries has been introduced by a group of senators, so it wouldn't be Sir Brendan Byrne, it would be Brendan Byrne GU. The government hasn't opposed it. I don't think anything's going to really come of it, but do we need an honours system in this country, Mary? Would you like to be Mary Cole, GU?
No. No, thank you. No, thank you. I think that's a bit above my station here. I think I'm happy enough the way I am. I just don't think there's a need for all of that. You know, at the end of the day, we have to have ordinary people doing ordinary jobs. Do you know, everybody can't go to college.
I'd love us to level the playing field, not create more hierarchies.
Yeah, absolutely. You need people to work on the ground, and we have to teach that to our youth, that it's okay to do ordinary jobs at home or wherever. I just feel we're losing so many of our youth to other countries. They're leaving Ireland, they're going away, they're not coming back for years. You know, we're doing something wrong, and we need to get this right because we need our own young people here at home.
Yeah, and to some extent maybe we're doing everything wrong, and that brings us back to the start of the conversation. In terms of its health, its housing, it's the, you know, and it's all that kind of stuff. But Brendan Byrne, GU, I don't think the GU part of it's sexy, really, to be honest with you. But anyway, do you think we need an honour system?
Well, the reality is we have a booming economy, but a failing country. We are a republic. Our constitution prohibits an honour system. I can't understand where it's motivating these people in trying to create an honour system.
And it's kind of right-leaning senators too, sort of conservative right-leaning senators. I don't think they'd mind me labelling as such. I actually don't really know where it is coming from. It's, you know, like Sharon Kogan and Ronan Mullins and Senator Crockwell, I think, are amongst those. I don't use those terms in a negative way, but I just don't really understand the motivation myself, if I'm honest.
You know, but certainly we don't need an honour system, but we do need it. We need to have a serious look at our system, from our public service to our political establishment right across the board, because I genuinely mean it. We are a failing country whilst the economy is booming.
Yeah, Aaron, in 30 seconds. I mean, I would go for, if it was captain, like if I could be Captain Greg Hughes or something, I think I could maybe vote for that. It just sounds a bit more, you know, I'd wear the white cap. And
with that beard, you look more like an admiral.
If I put the cap on, I'd look more like a member of the YMCA. Aaron, there's no harm in that either. Aaron, you're a young person again. I hate doing this labelling it, but it just gives a different perspective. Would you like?
I know, but it's
just that you come at it from a different angle. It's not that any of us are different in any way. Your views is equal to everyone's, but. Do you think your generation would like to see an honour system?
Not at all.
Great.
If you mentioned the word honour system to a lot of people I know, they probably wouldn't even know what you're talking about.
All right, Aaron, listen, come here. Great to have you back on the show. I can't believe the change on you. Let me put it like that. All right, maybe it's just school life or something.
I can surprise you sometimes, Greg.
Hey, come here. No, I'm only joking, and you know that. So thanks so much for your time. Take care. Brendan, thank you very much indeed. Always really great to get your views on stuff. And Mary, it's been brilliant having you on the programme as well. Thanks so much. Great to have you back on. And we really appreciate you accepting the invite. Have a wonderful day, will you? And keep doing
thank
the amazing work that you're doing. And I want to return to that conversation with you at another time, if that's okay. All right. Okay. Let us take a break for the news and obituary notices. Stay right where you are. Another busy hour on the way, including we'll kick off after 10, actually, with your comments that have been coming in so far.